Hello, Alan Saunders with you for an alcohol-fueled edition of the Philosopher's Zone.
Well, some folks like whiskey, and whiskey's mighty fine. Some folks like moonshine, Lord, they drink it all the time. My daddy taught me, said, son, only way to keep your head in line. Drink that wine, 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 keep your head stoned all the time.
Yes, and as the young blood sang back in the 1960s, a glass of Muscatel sets my mind up well. Or does it? Wine is much more than a convivial beverage shared among friends, as you'll know if you've ever read a wine review. I mean, does this wine really have notes of chocolate, truffle and violets? Can wines really be feminine, pretentious or cheeky? Can wines express emotion, or anything else for that matter? Do the judgments of experts have any objective validity, or is your taste as good as mine and anybody else's?
Drink that wine, 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 keep your head stoned all the time. Tell the truth.
To put all these questions in more philosophical terms, are the senses of taste and smell as structured as sight? What is the role of metaphor in the language of taste and smell? Is the production of tastes and smells an expressive art? And can objective statements be made about these things? Cain Todd is our guest this week. He's a lecturer in philosophy at Lancaster University in the United Kingdom and the author of The Philosophy of Wine, A Case for Truth, Beauty and Intoxication. Cain, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
I think it's reasonable to call your book pioneering because at the moment any philosophical writing about wine counts as pioneering. But there is certainly a lot more of it around than there used to be, isn't there?
No, that's absolutely right. It's very kind of you to call my book pioneering, but in fact it really rests on the shoulders of a number of other books that, as you say, have recently been written on wine. And there's something of a burgeoning interest amongst philosophers, but also amongst psychologists and even neuroscientists in our taste and smell capacities, and in particular in wine as the preeminent object that calls upon those capacities to discriminate and judge it.
One of the factors that might in the past have stood in the way of philosophical writing on this subject is that wine is all about taste and smell. I mean, we are interested in what it looks like and we hold the glass up to the light, but basically you don't just want to look at it, you want to taste it and you want to smell it. And for centuries, for philosophers, the one sense with which they were obsessed was sight.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And of course, there's good reason for that obsession, because we are essentially visual creatures. We navigate primarily by sight. I think most of us intuitively would think that sight is our preeminent sense, the most important sense that we have, and the one that we'd be the most loath to give up. So in some sense, there's very good reasons for this obsession over the centuries with sight. But it has, of course, meant that there's been a almost complete neglect of most of the other senses until relatively recently. Of course, people have always been interested in sound as well, because music and speech, of course, have such prominent roles in our life. But until very, very recently, most philosophers have not said anything at all really about our senses of taste and smell. And when they have said anything about them, it's mostly been rather disparaging. So they've held that they can't be structured in a way that sustains intellectual or aesthetic interest. And most people intuitively think, philosophers amongst them, that our abilities to taste and smell are just far too impoverished to spend much time dwelling philosophically on.
An issue here is that sight, and also hearing, is held to be representational. Sight represents to us something that is independent of our sight. It exists whether we see it or not. But taste and smell, it's said, don't represent anything. They're just chemically stimulated experiences that exist only in our bodies.
Yes, that's absolutely right. This is actually quite a murky area of philosophy, and as we speak, actually, there are more and more philosophers working on this notion of what representation actually is in perception. So it's something of a hot topic and something of a topic of debate. But intuitively, the basic idea is simply that in vision, we're presented with a world that seems to be independent of us. Moreover, it's a very informationally rich world that vision gives us, full of different properties, full of different objects, and vision's very good at individuating those objects. So our visual sense, as it were, represents the world to us as consisting of a vast array of objects with lots of properties attached to them, in a way that allows us to discriminate and individuate individual objects. And moreover, it appears to us in our actual experience of the world that those objects are the way they are, independently of us, existing in the world, in some sense, and with a figure-ground distinction, so that we can differentiate parts of the world and operate spatially around the world through sight. So sight is a very informationally rich sense that allows us to get about the world very effectively. That's right. And you might think that smell doesn't have those properties.
Well, one very sceptical conclusion that we might draw from this is that there is simply no such object as the real wine.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So one way of pursuing this idea that smells are not representational, or perhaps not representational in the way that, say, sight is to think that rather than being perceptions of an external reality, they're merely sensations. So when we smell, the object of our smell is in some sense in us. I mean, it's a chemical property that is in our nose or our brain, depending on how you think about that. And if that's the case, then you might say that when you're smelling even a complex object like wine, in some sense, what you're smelling is really just sensations. I mean, they're the object of your olfaction. And so there's no real way in which, if there is a wine object there out there in the world, then it would be difficult to say that we're smelling that as it really is, independently of how we smell it. But of course, everything here depends on what you mean by the wine object. So I think putting it that way is not very clear, because one might say, well, even if you're a subjectivist about our sensations of olfaction and gustation, you might say, well, the wine object still, of course, is common sense tells us there is a bottle of liquid there, full of chemical properties and volatile compounds. So in some sense, that is obviously an object, and we might call that the wine object. But if you want to refer to the wine object as that object consisting of our experiences of it as wine, and bearing the sort of elaborate descriptions that people are wont to give to wine, then in that case, if you're a subjectivist about smell and taste, you might think then, well, there's not much to the wine object other than our subjective experiences of it. And then there might be as many wine objects as there are people, if our smell and taste experiences are all very individual and subjective.
Well, that's what I was going to come on to. Even if there is a real wine, is there only one? Are you and I, with our different tastes and different degrees of experience, really tasting the same wine? Our experiences of the wine are likely to be different, whereas we're quite likely to agree on what the bottle that it came in looks like.
Right. This is a very difficult question to answer briefly and simply, because it bears a lot on very tricky philosophical notions to do with the nature of objectivity and subjectivity, and how we can know actually about any of our experiences, not just our taste and smell experiences, whether we share them. So one might be a radical skeptic about these kinds of claims to knowledge of other people in general. But I think it's safe to say that there is a broad knowledge of the kinds of chemicals and compounds that make up even as complex an object as wine, although there's no definitive list of all of them, of course. And we can give a pretty good story about how we causally, physiologically interact with a lot of these properties. So I suggest there's a kind of continuum of states here. I mean, there are some states where if the wine has a particular chemical like Brettanomyces in it, then it's safe to say that the majority of human beings will smell that as having a kind of leathery smell to it. And so judgments about those kinds of chemical interactions will be more or less objective, and we can say that to the extent that the wine object is constituted by those kinds of individual properties and causal responses in us, there's no more problem discussing the wine object or the taste that the wine has than there is in discussing the colours that objects have, and we can expect similar levels of agreement. But of course, things become much more complicated when we start discussing complex evaluative judgments about wine.
Well, I'll come on to complex evaluative judgments in a minute, but would it be fair to say that we've overestimated the representational character of sight and underestimated the representational character of taste and smell?
Oh, that's a very good question. I'm not sure whether we've overestimated the representational characteristics and capacities of sight. I think it's certainly true that we've underestimated, or at least misconstrued, the representational capacities of at least smell and perhaps taste as well. So one might very plausibly argue that smell, no less than sight, gives us access to the world. We can tell a very good evolutionary story about how smell can be informationally rich in human beings and is, as a fact, informationally very rich in other creatures. And so is an effective informational mechanism, has an informational function, if you like, that enables us to get by in the world. And as for its ability to represent, there don't seem to be any very good arguments for thinking that it can't represent. Most philosophers think it can't represent, or that its representational powers are very poor, because they think, at least implicitly, if not also explicitly, simply about the complexity that attaches to our visual representations of the world. But even if you accept that vision gives us more information about the world, is informationally richer and has a structure to experience consisting of a number of dimensions that smell doesn't, that by itself does not show that smell is not representational. But also a part of the problem here is that the very notion of the representational content of perception is a pretty nebulous, pretty vague notion, and there's a lot of dispute even amongst philosophers working centrally in this area about exactly what it means. So I think it's not much more than prejudice that has really explained why philosophers think that smell is not representational in the way that sight can be.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm sharing a philosophical conversation about wine, though sadly not a drink, with Cain Todd from Lancaster University. Cain, let's turn now to the language in which we talk about wine. There's a famous cartoon by James Thurber in which a man with a glass in his hand is saying to his fellow diners, "It's a naive domestic Burgundy without any breeding, but I think you'll be amused by its presumption."
Right.
Now, that's meant to be a joke, but it's only slightly a caricature. Metaphor, naive, breeding, presumption seems unavoidable when we talk about wine, doesn't it?
No, I think that's right. A lot of philosophers have been sceptical about, and a lot of non-philosophers, of course, have been sceptical about the sorts of language we use to describe wines, partly because they think that smells and tastes, partly for the reasons we've just been discussing, are just not the kinds of things that can bear these elaborate metaphorical, evaluative kinds of descriptions. But if you think about it, the way we talk about almost anything is riddled with metaphor. So the use of metaphorical language is not in itself something that we should be sceptical about or worried about. The question is really whether this bottle of liquid that contains volatile compounds is just the kind of thing that can be metaphorically described in the way that, you know, critics are wont to describe it. So that's one thing. And it's true that because we don't have a very well-developed vocabulary for describing tastes and smells, certainly nothing that corresponds to our description of, say, colours, then really the reliance on metaphor is inevitable, and metaphorical leaps of imagination, if you were, occur pretty quickly when we're trying to describe complex gustatory objects like bottles of wine.
Well, yes, metaphor does seem inevitable, but it functions in a particular way here. If I'm talking metaphorically about, for example, politics, I might say that Parliament has become a war zone. But that's a metaphor that I can translate into literal language. I can say, well, what I mean is that parliamentary debate has become very loud and angry. But when we apply metaphors to our experience of wine, we seem to be saying something that we can't say in any other way. We can use different metaphors, but we will still need to use metaphors.
I think that's right, but it's a complicated area because some things that appear metaphorical in wine language I don't think are best thought of as metaphorical. Or if they are metaphorical, then they can be cashed out in ways that are no more obscure than the kinds of example you've just given. So take, for example, terms like flabby to describe a wine. Well, you might say that, you know, wines cannot literally be flabby because flabby, you know, just doesn't, it's not the kind of concept that we can just apply to a sort of liquid or an experience of gustation. But flabby really has become conventionalized to the point where, at least amongst connoisseurs and experts. It's simply used to describe the lack of body in a wine, which you can detect on the palate. That usually refers to a lack of acidity. So the wine is unbalanced and therefore flabby because it lacks backbone. Now, of course, these are all sort of metaphors as well. But we can reduce a lot of these metaphors to pretty much basic literal descriptions of properties that the wine has, in this case, a lack of acidity. Of course, we can't purely cash it out that way because one needs to experience what that means. So if you've never drunk wine, then saying that it lacks body because it lacks acidity won't mean anything to you. But I don't think that our metaphorical descriptions of wine suffer in this respect in relation to any other feature of our metaphorical language, any other realm of discourse that uses metaphors.
And you want to argue that the boundary between the metaphorical and the literal is relatively fluid and continuous.
Yep. I think that's right. I think there's a kind of continuum here. It's a question of degree, really. So there are some words that look metaphorical, like flabby or perhaps like balanced, for instance, or having backbone, for that matter, or being feminine. Some of those metaphors we can tie pretty much directly to descriptive literal applications of language which describe perceptible properties of the wine. And those perceptible properties, it doesn't really take any expertise as such to perceive. But I think we build up from that kind of base to evaluate wines in quite complicated ways, and after all, they are very complex objects. And then we enter realms of metaphor and evaluation, which are much more, if you like, loosely tied to those basic descriptible, perceptible properties of the object, and really refer to the kinds of experiences that we can have of those perceptible properties. And that's when the metaphorical language becomes, if you like, a bit wilder and a bit looser, but nevertheless doesn't lose some kind of anchor to truthfulness if it's used well. So even where we have elaborate metaphors like Jancis Robinson described the 2009 Cheval Blanc, she said it's almost like a child told to concentrate and do its piano practice. Now, you might think that's ridiculous and doesn't tell us very much about the wine, but actually it makes perfect sense of the wine given the other things she says about it. And if you know quite a bit about Cheval Blanc and the 2009 vintage and so on, then you'll see that what she's getting at is that the wine for a Cheval Blanc within a certain category is relatively restrained, quite serious, but has elements of prettiness to it that relieve the seriousness, if you like. So it's a sort of like a serious child being playful on the piano. So I think it's a sort of apt metaphor. Or for instance, people often describe Cahors wines as being like Gothic cathedrals. Now, of course, literally, they're nothing like Gothic cathedrals, but one can make sense of the metaphor in virtue of the perceptible properties of the wine relative to other background factors that one might also know about the wine, different categories of judgments and so on.
Something we naturally want to know is whether our descriptions of wine or our evaluations of it or our evaluative descriptions can be objective. And here you invoke the great 18th century Scottish philosopher David Hume. What does he have to tell us?
Well, Hume's very useful in this area because he recognises on the one hand that there's a kind of paradox. He's mostly talking about aesthetic judgments rather than judgments of taste and smell per se, but they're quite similar in salient respects. So Hume recognises that on the one hand, these judgments we make about tastes and smells are subjective in the sense that there's a lot of disagreement about them. But on the other hand, of course, all of our practices of communication concerning these objects presupposes objectivity in the sense that there is also a lot of agreement about what constitutes a great work of art or a great wine, what constitutes a wine that's well balanced. So on the one hand, there's a lot of disagreement in individual judgments and lots of reason to think that our experiences differ between each individual. But on the other hand, our practices of evaluation and ranking and discourse all seem to presuppose an element of objectivity. And Hume's very useful because he gives us a way of reconciling these two apparently completely opposite tendencies. And the basic idea is this. He tells us to look at colour judgments. And colour judgments are interesting because, on the one hand, colour is subjective. It depends on human beings to perceive colours in the way that we do. And so when we describe a chair as blue, the concept of blueness latches onto refers to not just properties of the chair, but also to our experiences of those properties. So our perceptions of colours are ineliminably response-dependent. They're subjective in that sense. But of course, we don't think that colour judgments are subjective. We think that people can be wrong and right about them to some degree. So we wouldn't trust the colourblind person to tell us about the colours of the room that we're in. So we can give standards that ground norms for the correctness of our colour judgments, even though colours depend on human beings in the way that they just happen to be contingently constituted for their perception. And Hume argues that we can think of judgments about aesthetic qualities and by extension tastes and smells similarly.
He requires an ideal observer, though, doesn't he? I mean, in the case of wine, do we need an ideal taster?
Right, exactly. So colours, again, are different here because colours, it just seems that most human beings are wired up in the same way. So we all more or less perceive colours similarly. And that grounds the objectivity of our judgments, you might think. Whereas wine, of course, Hume himself says the properties are much harder to perceive, much more of a fine-grained, ephemeral, of course, tastes and smells, very ephemeral kinds of things. So unlike colours, you might think, and you might think also in the case of aesthetic properties, one needs to appeal to experts because one needs practice, one needs cultivation, one needs education, all sorts of things in order to discern these kinds of properties. So you're right, Hume thinks, or he propounds a kind of ideal observer theory for aesthetic qualities, and I think we need something similar to describe the norms that govern the correctness and therefore the objectivity of our judgments of wine.
Just finally, a character in a novel by Kingsley Amis imagines owning a brewery and promoting his brand with the winning slogan, "Makes you drunk." Well, wine can make you drunk as well. Is there anything philosophical to be said for intoxication?
I think there is. I mean, the person who's written with most insight about this is Roger Scruton, and I don't really have much more to add than what he's already done a great deal to outline here. But one important way of thinking about intoxication is this. Some intoxicating states can be produced by objects, like injected drugs, for instance, or drugs taken in some other way, where the experience that we then have, you know, whatever it might be, is not actually intentionally directed, as philosophers say. It's not anchored in, it doesn't have as its object the thing that caused the experience. Whereas the intoxication of objects like wine seem to be intentionally directed at and very firmly anchored in the object. So when we're intoxicated by wine as a kind of causal mechanism, it's the wine itself that remains, at least in large part, the object of our intoxication. And our intoxication has, therefore, a kind of intrinsic value to it because it's bound up with the intrinsic values of the wine that enabled it. So that's the first thing to be said. The second thing to be said for intoxication, I think this is very interesting and philosophers would do well to work more on this, is that the kind of intoxication that goes with, especially with wine and perhaps with other intoxicants, but preeminently with wine, I think, and there are good reasons for this, which we probably don't have time to explore, is that it more than any other intoxicant enables a kind of, as philosophers have recognized throughout the centuries and as a lot of common sense suggests, enables virtues like sociability and sincerity and humor and graciousness, those kinds of, you know, basically moral virtues that allow us to communicate our experiences to others. So a lot of philosophers have thought that wine, more than any other object, actually an experience, part of its intoxicating quality is to give us some ability to open up to others and to give some kind of insight into ourselves and into the nature of shared experience, rather than just getting us stupefied, if you like.
Well, I'll drink to that. And I think a corollary of what you said is I shouldn't be drinking alone.
No, exactly.
Cain Todd, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Cain Todd lectures in philosophy at Lancaster University, and he's the author of The Philosophy of Wine, A Case for Truth, Beauty and Intoxication. Details on our website, abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. The show is produced by Kyla Slavin, Charlie McCune is the sound engineer, I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll try to weave my intoxicated way back to the studio next week. Politics and business, I don't pay them no mind.
on all the time. Get out the back door, grandma, change.